is the Radio Hall of Fame. The Radio Hall of Fame is presented during the full hour ahead by the Philco Corporation, makers today of electronic battle equipment for the fighting forces of the United Nations, makers tomorrow of equipment for good living in a free world united by victory. Cooperating with Philco are the editors and correspondents of Variety, who report for the Philco program all the news of all show business the world over every week. This week, the editors of Variety recommend for your pleasure, and Philco delights to honor in your name, from radio in Hollywood, Fanny Bryce is Baby Snooks with Hanley Stafford.
From motion pictures, Laird Krieger.
From radio in New York, Gary Moore and Joan Edwards.
Conducting the Hall of Fame Orchestra and Chorus, Paul Whiteman.
Our master of ceremonies, the distinguished critic, composer, and commentator, Deems Taylor.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. This is Deems Taylor speaking for Philco. Perhaps it might be well to explain once more that the Philco Hall of Fame is unique among radio reviews in this special respect. It offers you a second chance to hear the good things that you may have missed on the air, in the movies, and in the theater. In a sense, this might be called, well, a show of shows, a return engagement for the best in entertainment of all sorts, chosen by the show-wise editors and correspondents of Variety. You or I, being equipped with only one set of ears apiece, can't hear everything all over the dial. Variety owns 1,000 ears, all of them listening for you. A rather touching thought, come to think of it. Easy on any ear always is the music of Paul Whiteman. Paul reaches back in the direction of Vincent Newman for his cameo overture this week for the Hall of Fame album of musical memories, Drums in My Heart.
Thank you.
show business, like life, is always copying itself. And, of course, one of the theater's most frequently repeated myths is the saga of overnight rise to stardom. It does happen sometimes, just like in the movies. It happened recently to Gary Moore, now co-star with Jimmy Durante on the Friday Night Camel show. After 7 years of plugging along on early morning programs, Gary made his first guest appearance on the Camel Caravan about a year ago. Well, within 24 hours, Gary had been signed to that inevitable long-term contract. And he's been on the air ever since, writing his own stuff most of the time, a distinction that he shares with Fred Allen. Variety has suggested that we recreate, as far as possible, his fortunate first appearance. And for that purpose, enter Gary Moore. At least I think I've introduced the right man. You are Gary Moore, aren't you?
Yes, I am. Doesn't it make you sick? It does me sometimes.
Now, you're just being modest, my lad. I've read a lot of nice things about you.
Oh, daughter, you've probably read about my uncle. He used to make his living by sticking his right arm in a lion's mouth.
Now there's a job. What do you call a man who makes his living by sticking his right arm in a lion's mouth?
We call him Lefty. He does all right, though. He now has a new hobby. He sticks his left hand into electric light sockets.
But I should think the electricity would go right through him.
Why, certainly. He is now the only man in the world who can take off his shirt, ripple his muscles, and get Algiers. You'd like him, really.
I'm sure I would. But let's talk about you, Mr. Moore. Tell us something about yourself. Where were you born?
Well, Mr. Taylor, strictly speaking, I wasn't really born at all. My family filled in the last line of a limerick, and I was mailed to the house. Oh, it was a great event, I tell you. I arrived on New Year's morning, and for 3 days, my father thought I was a hangover. It's a terrible, terrible shock to the old gentleman.
Yes, I can imagine. But skipping the old gentleman, what about your career? How did you get started?
Well, for the first 3 years of my life, I didn't do much of anything. Just kind of lolled around in a semi-moist condition. Beating myself on the head with my rattle and loving every minute of it. And then at the age of 4, I began to worry about the world and its wonders. Such things as the moon and the stars and why there's a faucet drip.
Yes, there is a neat problem. Why does a faucet drip?
Because it can't go... Very elementary.
Well. And all this from such a little fellow.
Oh, but Mr. Taylor, I've always been a little fellow. You can believe this or not, but until I was 13, I was so small, my mother used my head as a darning aid. Yes, she did, and soon tiring of this treatment, I left home and got myself a job as an olive stuffer, in which capacity I would crawl through the olive, dragging the pimento behind me. I was happy for quite some time, but it was grueling work, so I decided to go into show business. And just 1 year ago, I came to New York, where a group of radio executives assembled at the bus station voted me the man most likely to use the return portion of his round-trip ticket. So, you see, my life has been a difficult one.
Yes, well, I do hope that we can make you happier here tonight.
Well, bless your flock, a little heart. I hope so, too. And I could be very happy here if only you'd let me sing.
Egad, do you sing, too?
Well, not really sing. It's really nothing more than gastritis and tempo. But I'm tone deaf, so I enjoy it. And for my song, girls, I have chosen that lovely ballad of years ago, June and January. You will listen, won't you? Girls. Thank you so much. Bye, so.
It's June in January. Because I'm in love, but only because I'm in love with you in my heart. Ah, yes, my darling, June and January, that was the way it was in our hearts, always warm and sunny. I shall never forget when we met, my sweet. I was sitting in a nightclub. My fingers were cold and I dropped my hypodermic. I looked under the table to pick it up, and there you were, my sweet. Ah, yes, there you were with those eyes, those lips, that tooth. No one knew how long you'd been there. The only means of identification was a campaign button reading Tippecanoe and Tyler, too. Ah, but I took you by the hand, my angel, and I shall never forget how it felt to hold your hand like milking a seal. But I took you by the hand and I looked into your eyes.
especially the blue one. The brown one, as I recall, was closed for the duration. But I looked into your blue eye, and with my voice just soaking with love, emotion, and 7-Up, I said, Annabella, will you marry me? You said no. So I left you have one right in the chops. How we could have been so happy, my sweet. You crouched there under the table as the band played Margie, and I kicked you on the offbeat 8 to the bar. We could have been so happy, my love. But then, it happened. It was just an average summer's day. We were walking down Fifth Avenue, casually window shopping. Oh, we noticed the building under construction, yes, but there were no danger signs, nothing to warn the passerby. From high atop the skeleton frame, a giant crane was lifting a piece of girder steel. So safe it seemed, so strong and safe. Suddenly I heard the awful sound of snapping cables. Look out, Annabella! It's falling! It's falling! Annabella, the girder is falling!
Ah! It's June in January. But only because.
For many years, you have known the Philco name as the leader in the field of radio and radio phonographs. In fact, that leadership for 12 straight years has made Philco, by a wide margin, the world's largest radio manufacturer. But in recent years, the Philco name has become widely known as well in the field of refrigeration. Today, thousands of homes are enjoying the convenience and comfort of the new ideas and exclusive features which Philco Engineering has brought them in a Philco refrigerator. The huge separate frozen food compartment, the freshener shelf, the conservador. These are important advantages in today's wartime living which only Philco refrigerator owners may enjoy. The Philco radio, phonograph, or refrigerator you may have bought this year is now fighting on many fronts, in a plane, a tank, or a ship. It is a product of combined research and manufacturing experience of Philco radio and refrigeration engineers. And this diversified scientific knowledge is adding up to a new kind of Philco leadership after the war. Out of its many contributions to victory, the legacy of Philco war research will be new comfort, new convenience, and new entertainment for the homes of America. In radio, television, refrigeration, and air conditioning.
The number one hit parade girl and the number one hit parade song. That, in Variety's august opinion, is a combination worthy of immediate inclusion in the Philco Hall of Fame, the pinup girl department. The girl, Joan Edwards. The song, My Heart Tells Me.
My heart tells me this is just a fling. Yet you say our love means everything. Do you mean what you are saying? Or is this a little game you're playing? My heart tells me I will cry again. Lips that kiss like yours could lie again. If I'm fool enough to see I do, should I believe sorry if I do.
Variety recommends, and Philco is pleased to honor, Mr. Laird Tregear. You'll notice, perhaps, that I said Mr. Laird Tregear. Laird deserves that formal handle, generally reserved in Hollywood for Mr. Paul Mooney, by virtue of the distinguished nature of his performance record. Like Mooney, he's an actor's actor, a technician in the art of the theater. And like Gary Moore, he rose to spectacular celebrity overnight. A brief summary of his career might read, born in Philadelphia, educated in England, starved in Hollywood. The starvation period ended when he played Oscar Wilde in a West Coast production of the play by that name, thus sending the local producers into a dither of dollar waving. You've seen his 6'3" frame in Heaven Can Wait, Blood and Sand, and Holy Matrimony. You will see him soon in 20th Century Thriller, The Lodger. And you'll hear him now in an original radio drama by Milton Geiger. This is Laird Tregear in Moonlight.
In the moonlight, in the night, in the molten tropic ocean stands the jungle island. Softly the moonlight dwells upon the sand, flickers among the palms, the giant ferns. Then down, down through the tropic trees, the moonlight filters, glancing upon the moss-grown trunks of apatong and tindalo trees. Down, down through the ancient branches clothed in moss and vines, where the flitting fruit bats ply and fly. Down to the jungle floor filters the moonlight. The mottled moonlight harlequins the earth, and a pale white face that stares upward, speechless, through the trees. A man, a wounded soldier. The man is motionless. Over him flutter two white moths, phantasmal in the moonlight. No, not monstrous moths, but hands. A woman's hands. There in the reeking wilderness, sure and swift, and charged with mercy.
I found him here. I knew his wound was serious. I'm glad you came, Major.
Yes. We may pull through. I wish we had a better light than moonlight, though.
We show a light, well. There's no knowing who still might be watching from the jungle, Major.
We'll chance it in the dark, that's all. More pressure on this vessel, please. That's good.
Don't try to speak so. We're here. You'll be all right.
There was a battle.
Yes.
Yes, there was a battle. A volcano flamed upon the sea and beat upon the island, swept the beach with flame, and sent 1,000 crouching deaths stalking through the green jungle with blade and bayonet and gun. The sea rocked and thundered with the headlong fury of the battle fleets. The churning phosphorescent wakes of cruiser and destroyer flushed a sudden pink, fading as quickly as the spending blood of men could be dispersed by the vastness of the ocean. Overhead, the bombers and torpedo planes hunted in the sky, teaching the willing vultures how to fly and where.
Soften in a match, please.
Shall I use his own supply?
No, better not. We'll have to move him to get at us, and I'd rather not. Due to what we have.
Right.
Okay.
Easy, soldier. Don't try to talk.
I think you'll do all right, boy. Just take it easy.
The enemy. Okay. We've met them on the beach.
We know, Sam. It was a tough show.
Easy, soldier. We met them on the beach. In the water.
They came, the crouching, capable little men, and he met them on the beach, fought them in the surf, hand to hand, knife to naked throat, cheek by jowl, claw and fang, and the sharks were smiling, witness to the combat. Then back into the jungle they pressed the soldier. Like his comrades, the odds 10-1, and here in the glade, ambushed by a score of guns, he fell. The soldier fell. They would not let him fall alone, but the guns and the streaming, chattering lead must follow him down, must walk with him like the perfect host to the very door of death to bid him speed. Oh, hospitable foe. Then the fleet left. One fleet left its living, and both fleets had their dead. And where war had swollen its veins in passion, now came mercy. Now came service. Now came the good and not the evil of science.
It's all right, soldier. We're here.
Now came the gentle hands charged with mercy. Knowledge and humanity knelt in the moss beside the wounded soldier. And he was the master, and they the servants. And there was no humility too much for them. No danger from man or poisoned wilderness too great. Consider then these three. Consider the two who kneel upon the stricken earth, the night alive and perilous about them. They serve, and serving, kneel. They kneel. They stoop willingly to the unconquered. Duty or privilege? Will there still be any to cry out in this sheltered, easy living land, not that they must sacrifice their bread, but that they must do without the frosting on their cake? Forbid it. Seeing these three, these intimates of suffering and blood and pain, will some voices still echo in the safe and sanitary halls of home and behind the bright shield of democracy speak to divide the people while these three, the hurt, the weary, and in danger are one? Forbid it, I say. Will one voice rise to complain that the front takes off our doctors and our nurses? Or while one single soldier bleeds, and while men and women fight to stanch that fatal flow, can any yawn and say, I think I have anemia, or I have no time, or will it hurt to give a pint of blood to save a soldier's life? Scorn. Scorn and ashes upon him, if there be such voice.
Things look much better, Doctor, wouldn't you say?
Yes. Yes, we'll be all right. Thank God.
Thank God for listening.
All right.
He's a major.
Thank you, Major, sir. That's nothing, boy. Glad we can help.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Is there any pain?
He's fine. Pretty good.
He ought to move him, but he ought to have some sleep, too. Prepare a hypodermic, Lieutenant.
The soldier's eyes are bright with fever in the moonlight. Yet he smiles. His breath comes deep and even. And he smiles. The wind speaks softly in the trees. The moonlight ripples on the sea. Harlequins the jungle floor.
Hypodermic ready, sir.
Thank you.
The soldier sleeps. He smiles in his sleep. Does he dream of home and sunlight in a child's yellow hair? Of lips and limpid eyes and a woman's warm laughter? Does he scent the spicy fragrance of the grocery store, where it once pleased him to serve his fellows in another way? Never mind. His dreams are his. He rests. His wounds are tended, and the soldier sleeps.
I can't move him tonight. I ought to be getting on. He knows there's plenty of work to be done.
Got time.
They're hurt. Someone ought to stay with this boy here.
I'll stay.
You haven't slept in 40 hours yourself.
I'll stay.
Thanks. Good night. If there's any trouble, use your head.
She kneels upon the jungle ooze. Her cloak is his. Her eyes are his. Her watchfulness, her courage, and her strength, all his. Helpless, he is the master. Speechless, he commands. And she does his bidding. She waits. She keeps her vigil over this son, this brother, husband, sweetheart, father. Moonlight. In the moonlight, in the night, in the molten tropic ocean stands the jungle island. Softly the moonlight dwells upon the glade, softly shimmers where a soldier sleeps and a woman watches. He will not be forsaken. He will not be forgotten or betrayed while a nation has its honor and its power. The wounded soldier sleeps. Let him sleep. Yes, let him sleep. Moderate for his sake the high-pitched hum of your buying and your selling. Turn off the jukebox if you can bear a brief silence. Quiet the shrill laughter of your girl children haunting the streets at night. Put up a sign, a neon sign in three colors if you wish, reading, Quiet. Here rests, in the valley of the shadow of death, a boy from home. Quiet. Muffle for a moment the snarling, rat-like sound of your search for profit and advantage. Bid your brigade of quibbling lawyers to be still. As you love your own life, you at home, let him sleep. Let the boy sleep in the moonlight. Far from home, in the moonlight, in the moonlight, let him sleep.
Lazy, beneficent, and unusually gifted octopus, the network detaches its limbs from its main body, permitting each tentacle proudly to name itself. Once this curious feat has been accomplished, we have a rendezvous with Paul Whiteman, Joan Edwards, Gary Moore, and Fanny Bryce. Now, if you, Mr. Riggs, would please nudge the well-disposed octopus.
I keep telling you, Mr. Taylor, this is the Blue Network.
Radio Hall of Fame, Act Two. You know, I think some comment should be made at this point upon Paul Whiteman's pants. Ever since the Hall of Fame began, our studio audience has marveled weekly at Paul's sartorial elegance. This being roughly 6:30 p.m. Eastern wartime, Paul and his musicians are suitably arrayed in formal afternoon dress. Well, that means striped pants, of course. But Paul's personal pants are sheer, crystallized, worsted beauty. From their voluminous folds, a tent could be run up, a wedding canopy arranged, a banquet hall suitably draped in tapestry. It has been said with some truth that Paul can take free steps in those pants without appearing to be in motion.
One moment, please. Who slanders my fancy pants slanders my name, and I thank you, Deems, to confine your remarks to the business at hand.
And the business at hand happens to be?
A tune from a Connecticut Yankee by Richard Rogers. We've been too long getting around to Dick on the Hall of Fame. I propose to remedy that oversight on our part at once.
The pants, followed by Paul, move majestically back to the podium. And we hear My Heart Stood Still from the current revival hit, The Connecticut Yankee. Those listeners with long memories and minds like so many steel traps will recall that at the opening of this program, I pointed out that the Radio Hall of Fame aims to bring you big moments from radio's past, to give you a second chance to hear memorable things and stuff. We apply this general principle now to the case of Gary Moore. On his Camel show, Gary has maintained a regular feature entitled Well-Known Stories of Little-Known People. In a meeting of minds between Gary and Variety, one of the best of these quaint tales has been selected. And we hear tonight.
Tonight, Deems, we hear the story of one of the most fascinating men I have ever known. A man named Binswanger Drinch. I thought you ought to know about Binswanger Drinch, for Binswanger had a very sad lot. It was all covered with weeds. He was born in the little town of Pennsylvania, a one-horse town. But 2 years later, his family moved to New Jersey, a two-horse town. But whether he was born in or is unimportant. He could even have lived in Pittsburgh, North Dakota. His story would have been the same. Wishing to see the outside world, Binswanger ran away from home at the age of 4. At the age of 5, he came back home. His parents took one look at him, then they ran away from home. But aside from this brief fling, our hero led a very sheltered existence. Until he was 21, life was a complete mystery to him. But on his 21st birthday, his father said to him, Binswanger, my son.
Yes, Papa?
Today you are a man. Today I am going to let you...
Papa, you mean...
Yes, son. You may look at the lady's side of the laundry list. And that was the turning point in the life of Binswanger Drinch. The foolish boy took advantage of his father's leniency and soon began chewing gum, wearing loud sleeve garters, and drinking root beer with Pepsi-Cola chasers. Eventually, he started gambling with his playmates and was even caught playing tiddlywinks with loaded tiddlies. Finally, one day, his father said to him, I warn you, Binswanger, you can't burn the candle at both ends. His father should never have made that remark. For then and there, Binswanger determined to find a candle he could burn at both ends. In 2 years, he searched every town in the United States and parts of Brooklyn. But all in vain. Then London saw him, Paris saw him, Moscow saw him, China saw him, Ethiopia, Venezuela, Central Europe, Spain, and Turkey, West East Indies, Denmark, Portugal, Belgium, Iceland, Sweden, Canada, Norway, Egypt, and the Gentleman's Lounge in Radio City. And at the end of his travels, Binswanger had 14 trunks full of candles that burned only at one end. Sadly, Binswanger opened the trunks to dispose of these candles. He opened the trunk marked North Africa, and a wonderful thing had happened. Horrible African heat had melted the ends of two candles together, making one long candle with a long wick extending from each end. Hardly breathing, Binswanger lit one wick. With hands a-tremble, he touched the match to the other. Would it catch fire? Would it catch fire? Would it catch fire? It did! Binswanger Drinch was burning his candle at both ends! Smiling and triumphant, Binswanger put the candle in his back pocket and started for home. But poor Binswanger, before he put the candle in his back pocket, he forgot to blow out the flames. And soon he felt something burning. And if you want to know what it was, well, it was the end of Binswanger Drinch.
We enter, walking like beauty in the night, Miss Joan Edwards. Joan is that rare creature, a native-born New Yorker. She entered show business under the protecting wing of her famous uncle, Gus Edwards, as a piano accompanist for the dancer Armida. Some years back, our Mr. Whiteman, he of the fancy pants, conducted a search for a good singer who could also cope with the keyboard in acceptable fashion. Joan Edwards was the answer to Paul's prayer. With his assistance, she recreates a familiar situation. At the piano, Joan Edwards, waving a willowy baton, Paul Whiteman. The result, Besame Mucho. Thank you.
Each time I cling to your kiss, I hear music divine. Bésame mucho. Hold me, my darling, and say that you'll always be mine. This joy is something new, my arms enfolding. You never knew this thrill before. Whoever thought I'd be holding you close to me, whispering with you I adore. Dearest one, if you should leave me, each little dream would take wing and my life would be through. Bésame mucho. Love me forever and make all my dreams come true.
One thing to conceive and design a piece of war equipment. Quite another to build it so that it works under all possible conditions of modern warfare. As an example, the radio division of Philco wanted to make sure that the radio and electronic equipment they are building for the planes of our Army and Navy would give unfailing performance under all conditions of air combat, on the ground, and in the stratosphere. So they called upon the refrigeration division of Philco to bring the stratosphere to their laboratories. Their engineers designed a huge insulated chamber with ingenious mechanism that duplicates all conditions of pressure and temperature from the ground up to 13 miles in the air. In this chamber, Philco aircraft radio equipment is given a relentless workout. It is put through its paces in severe cold and rarefied atmosphere. In seconds, it shoots up from the ground to 30,000 feet in the air. Only when it can pass these tests does a piece of Philco equipment qualify for use in the planes of our Army and Navy. This is an example of how the diversified research experience of the Philco laboratories has functioned to help give our fighting men that superiority of striking power which is carrying them to victory. It is an example, too, of the standards of precision and quality which will build the peacetime miracles of radio, television, refrigeration, and air conditioning which will appear under the famous Philco name.
Thousand miles to my right, in the wings of the Coast to Coast Hall of Fame, stand Fanny Bryce, dressed as Baby Snooks, and Hanley Stafford, looking grim as usual. Variety recommends and Philco honors Fanny Bryce for a lifetime of laughter in the theater and on the air. Long before Baby Snooks was born, Miss Bryce had achieved the sort of theatrical immortality that commends itself to the Hall of Fame. The lasting place earned by Snooks in the hearts of her countrymen is therefore only one reason among many for the presence of Fanny Bryce on the hall today. Like all our American laughter makers, Fanny Bryce has given freely and generously of her time and thought toward helping every phase of the war effort. For her performance today, for instance, we've chosen a sketch written in cooperation with the Office of War Information. As our curtain rises in Hollywood, we find Daddy deeply involved in a momentous laboratory experiment in the basement of his home.
Ha-ha! Nobody will believe it. Scientists working madly to produce oil and grease from everything from peanuts to popcorn, and here's millions and millions of gallons of it going down the drain every day. Ah, I'll bet I'll look great in my congressional medal.
What are you doing, Daddy?
Snopes, I've told you time and again not to disturb me while I'm working in my laboratory.
I'm disturbing you?
You most certainly are. Now go upstairs and let me work.
I'll be quiet, Daddy.
That doesn't matter. Your very presence disturbs me.
All right, I won't bring you no presents.
Now, Snooks, you're just trying to aggravate me. You know very well, when I start an experiment in here, I must have privacy.
Why?
Do you think that Seth Thomas could have invented an alarm clock if he had 9 kids bouncing in and out?
If he had 9 kids, he wouldn't need an alarm clock.
You can say that again.
All right. If we had 9...
Never mind. Just let me work in peace.
What are you working on, Daddy?
Snooks, this is the most important experiment of my entire career. Yes. Can you imagine this war being won by a frying pan?
Huh?
A frying pan. A single housewife equipped with a frying pan will indirectly wipe out the enemy.
Is Mommy going to cook for the Japs?
No, Mummy's not going to cook for the Japs.
Mm-hmm.
Not that they don't deserve it. I'm just using the frying pan symbolically.
Oh, symbolic.
Yes. Look, when Mummy puts an egg in the frying pan, what does she use to fry it with?
Gas.
No, I mean what's in the pan.
An egg.
Besides the egg. In all kinds of cooking and frying, a certain amount of fat or grease is used.
Why?
Well, it seals in the flavor of the food and stops it from sticking to the receptacle.
Mm-hmm.
Now, when we fry an egg in a pan, some of the grease is left over. What do we do with it?
We rub it on a chicken so she can lay on that egg.
Nothing of the kind.
No.
We pour it into a clean can and take it to the butcher shop. What for?
So the butcher can fry eggs.
No. He collects the used fats and grease and turns it over to the government. The government wants 200 million pounds of waste fats this year.
And so we've got a fat waste.
Not fat waste. Waste fats. If we could render Aunt Sophie, we wouldn't need this campaign at all.
What campaign?
To recover the waste fats from the kitchens. They need it.
Who needs it?
The government. And not enough housewives are turning it in. Over 60% of them are either neglectful or else they don't know about the campaign.
What campaign?
The Fats and Grease campaign. I just told you Washington has asked for 200 million pounds of fats this year.
George Washington?
No, Washington, D.C. That's the seat of our armies.
The army needs fat on their feet?
Yes.
Why?
Oh, so they can blow up the panzers. What are you yelling about?
You scared me.
Well, I didn't mean to. I just want you to know how important it is for everybody to take their waste fats and grease to the butcher.
Mm-hmm.
Just like they take money to the bank or buy bonds with it.
You can buy bonds with grease?
Well, not actually. Although you do get paid for whatever you turn in. But it serves almost the same purpose. Money is ammunition, and so is waste fats.
How do they shoot it?
Oh, they don't shoot it. They remove the glycerin from it. You can't make explosives without glycerin.
Mm-hmm.
And since the oils from which we formerly obtained our glycerin can no longer be imported, practically all of the glycerin needed for gunpowder and other vital war materials must be delivered through this campaign.
What campaign?
The campaign to salvage waste fats! Listen, what does Mummy do with the grease from her pan?
She wipes it off with Kleenex and goes to bed.
I'm not talking about her face.
Why?
For the same reason you don't talk about your football.
I ain't got a football.
I know it. Furthermore, Mommy would be a lot better off if she didn't spend so much time and money on beauty preparations. Somebody should tell her she can't make a silk purse out of a sow's ear.
Has Mommy got a sow's ear?
The question has merit. But I won't answer it now. I've got to get back to work.
What are you working on?
A solution to the entire campaign.
What campaign?
What have I been telling you for the last 5 minutes?
The government needs fried eggs.
They don't need fried eggs. They need waste fats. And I've discovered a way to eliminate cooking fats and oils completely. Then the government can have it all.
How do you do it?
Look at this pantsuit. What's in it?
Mud.
No, it's oil. Cooking oil.
Where'd you get it?
I made it.
You made it?
Yes. Years ago, people used to cook with bacon grease or pork fat. Then somebody discovered how to get oil from vegetables, even peanuts.
Mm-hmm.
Well, this oil you see here is neither animal nor vegetable.
Is it mineral oil?
In a sense, yes. I drained it out of my crankcase.
Huh?
Motorists change their oil every 1,000 miles, and the stuff is considered worthless because it's full of dirt and carbon. Well, it may not be any good to lubricate a motor, but does that mean it's no good for cooking?
You mean that stuff that came out of your car?
Oh, I've refined it already.
Oh, yes.
Yes. In that pan is a pint of perfectly good cooking oil. I made it from 4 quarts of crankcase oil.
How did you do it?
Well, I distilled it several times, washed out the sediment, added a little melted butter and a pound of bacon just for taste. And there it is.
Where's the bacon?
Oh, I had to throw it away. Got kind of dried out.
Yeah.
You want to see me fry an egg with this oil?
Maybe the egg will get dried out.
Don't be silly. It'll do a beautiful job. Now watch this. I'll put a small amount in the skillet and place it over the Bunsen burner. So?
It's starting to smoke, Daddy.
Oh, that can't be helped.
Huh?
I couldn't get all the gasoline out of it. Hand me an egg.
Here.
Thanks. Now, I'll just crack it, drop it in the hot oil. Hand me another egg, Snooks.
Take out the ashes first, Daddy.
Stuff heats very fast.
Yeah.
Better cut this light down. There. Now let's see. Drop it in gently. Aha! That one didn't burn, did it?
Why is it turning green?
Well, the color doesn't matter. It's how it tastes that counts.
Oh.
Here, let me get it out. It's done just right. All right?
All right what?
Taste it.
Now you taste it.
Go on, taste it. I've just had my dinner.
Well, have it for your supper.
Oh, taste the egg. I wouldn't want to poison you, would I? Would I?
Wouldn't you?
Okay, then I'll taste it.
Oh, bring the basket quick. Oh.
Get rid of it, Daddy. Here. You feel all right?
Oh, that's awful.
Yeah.
Oh, this stuff won't work unless you change your oil every 500 miles.
I don't think it'll work at all, Daddy.
Oh, well, maybe you're right. Well, I was only trying to save fats and grease for the government.
I know how you can make eggs without using any grease, Daddy.
You do? How?
You just boil them.
I'll submit the plan to Washington right away. Let's go, Snooks.
Yeah.
Thank you.
next week on the Radio Hall of Fame, Tallulah Bankhead, Gertrude Neeson, Alan Young, and the cast of Can You Top This? We'll expect you at the gates of the hall this time next week, this station. Signed, Deems Taylor.
The production and writing staff of the Radio Hall of Fame includes D. Engelbach, George Faulkner, and Abel Green, editor of Variety. Fanny Price is presented by courtesy of her sponsor, Maxwell House. Gary Moore, by courtesy of Camel Cigarettes. Joan Edwards appears regularly on Your Hit Parade. Laird Cregar was presented by arrangement with 20th Century Fox Pictures. This is Glenn Riggs saying goodnight for Philco dealers and distributors throughout the United States and Canada. And from the Philco Corporation, makers today of radio, communications, and electronic materials to help win the war. Makers tomorrow of materials for good living in a world at peace.